Well, we need to start this sermon with some lyrics from a country song that was popular. I was trying to remember when I heard it. I remember where I was driving. It was down a certain street in Eugene, Oregon. I usually remember songs based on where I am when I hear them, I guess. Maybe you're the same. But this one must have been about 12 or 14 years ago. Sawyer Brown was the singer. And it's called Thank God for You. But there's the rest of the song is immaterial to the sermon. All I'm interested in is two lines out of the chorus line that I think are interesting and important for us today for the purpose of this message. He sings in the chorus, "I gotta thank Mama for the cooking, Daddy for the whooping, the devil for the trouble that I get into. I've got to give credit where credit is due." He has to thank the devil for the trouble that he gets into, and he has to give credit where credit is due. So the title of this sermon is Giving the Devil His Due. Giving the Devil His Due. And we're coming up on Atonement, so this is an appropriate time to address this, although it's not a bad time. Most any time of the year to size up our adversary and refresh our minds on his tactics and his plans for torpedoing our chances of being in the kingdom of God. If he wins, we lose. But we intend to win, and we intend for him to lose as it is supposed to be. Now, on the Day of Atonement, we get into this, and in fact, you may cover some of these passages, or at least a few of the verses, in the course of the Atonement sermon. But I think it would be good just to spend a little time going into a little bit more detail about what it says. First, let's look at the command for the Day of Atonement. That's in Leviticus. It's in chapter 23. Then we go to another chapter and another chapter after that. Leviticus 23. This is the catalog of all the annual holy days of God, a chapter that is unfortunately completely overlooked by traditional Christianity. They have no concept that this is an important chapter. When you were called into God's church, you began to realize how important this chapter was. All year long, year in and year out, because this is the catalog of God's holy days. Not the world's holy days, not the world's holidays, not the world's saint days, or whatever they might be called, but the catalog of God's holy days. It starts, of course, with the weekly Sabbath, the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, the Feast of Weeks, also known as Pentecost, the Feast of Trumpets, and then the Day of Atonement. Tabernacles is included as well. It comes in toward the end, but let's look in verse 26. The Lord said to Moses, "On the 10th day of the 7th month." Now, the 7th month is by the reckoning of God's calendar, which is essentially the obvious one, is the Hebrew calendar, traditional Hebrew calendar. It's on the 7th month. That will be the Day of Atonement, on the 10th of that month. "And you will afflict your souls." Now, we understand from comparative reading and following through what it means to afflict your soul. It means to fast. You don't eat anything and you don't drink anything, including coffee, and you wish that you hadn't drunk so much coffee the day before because that's where the headache comes from. So it's always a good idea to knock off the caffeine a little bit. Not necessarily entirely, but it depends on how many quarts of coffee a day that you drink. I don't know if anybody does that, but I used to know some people that they measured the coffee they drank daily by the pot. Which was pretty close to a quart, maybe even more than a quart. 2-3 pots of coffee a day. That's a lot of caffeine, especially when you're talking about Robusta beans. There are two kinds of coffee beans, Robusta beans and Arabica beans. The really good coffee are the Arabica beans, and they're more expensive too. The Robusta beans are the lowland coffee that they can machine harvest. And they're very high in caffeine and very high in acid. So you make a net drop when you go to the fancy coffees. You lose nearly half the acid, nearly half the caffeine, just shifting to a different bean. But you get a lot more flavor. But this isn't a coffee commercial. And Now, if we were fasting, I might play that one a little longer, and you know, so you could think about it. Sometimes it's fun to describe things we enjoy tasting or eating on a fast day like the Day of Atonement. But getting back to this, it's on the 10th day of the 7th month we afflict our souls to make an atonement for any person who is not afflicted in soul on that same day shall be cut off from his people. Obviously, we have made adjustments for those who are, you know, ill or infirm or very small or with certain medications. And I'm sure that that would have been made as well. You afflict your soul or you fast as much as you're able to within the parameters of that. And that's been a long time understanding and teaching of the church through the other principles of God's Word. But still, we participate in it to the degree that our health permits. And, of course, it is a day that we don't work on the Day of Atonement. In verse 31, it says, "You shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest." So the Day of Atonement, middle of the week this year, is a Sabbath. "And you shall afflict your souls on the ninth day of the month at evening," meaning as the sun goes down, and from evening to evening until the next evening. So this is the command for the Day of Atonement. This is the starve day. Somebody was telling me the other day, a friend of theirs found out that the person we're talking about here was in the church, and so he said, "Do you starve?" You know, what he meant was, "Do you fast?" But he couldn't think of the word. And that's, you know, that's not surprising. Most people in society don't fast. They don't even use the word, except very rarely, and usually in a medicinal discussion. So he just thought of it as starving. Yes, we starve for a whole day, but, you know, you survive. That's why we lay on just a little extra around the middle so we can burn it off when it comes to the Day of Atonement. But it is a day that we're commanded to keep, and it's a marvelous day. It has a lot of exciting things. Let's go to chapter... hold it. Did I cover? Yes, I did. Let's go to chapter 16 now. Chapter 16 has the ceremony that was done at the tabernacle in the wilderness when Israel was wandering out of Egypt and over toward Israel. They didn't have Google Maps in those days, so they wandered. It wouldn't have made any difference anyway, because God would have messed with Google Maps to make sure they wandered, because they had some wandering to do during those 40 years. But whatever the case, they had the tabernacle then. That was essentially a portable temple. And it was, you know, set up when God told them, he stopped either the cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night. And when that moved, one or the other moved, then Israel moved. They had to be good at, you know, packing up everything real quickly and falling into line. They did it in a very orderly fashion. You can read about that in Numbers, how the tribes fell in. Certain ones led, certain ones were the vanguard in the rear, and the tribe of Levi came kind of in the middle, carrying all the paraphernalia that had to do with the tabernacle as well as their own things. It was very organized, and they got good at packing up and getting ready to go whenever the God gave them the signal, and either moving the cloud or by moving the pillar of fire. That has to be an adventure, a long adventure, for those people at that time. But they would come to the Day of Atonement, and the tabernacle would be set up, and later this ceremony would have been done at the temple that Solomon built in Jerusalem. And we'll read about it as it was given for Aaron to initially do. So at one point, the first Day of Atonement came around, Aaron was the one to do this the first time. Verse 6, "Aaron shall offer a bull as a sin offering." So there was a bull involved in the offerings. There were a number of animals offered on the Day of Atonement, and not just the two goats. Well, the goats are the most famous, and that's really what we're coming down to look at the goats and their significance. But there were other things. The bull was a sin offering for himself and for his house or his family. that he had to come before God and make this offering, and God accepted that offering, and then Aaron could go ahead to officiate at the rest of what God had commanded him to do. So once he's done that, then he shall take the two goats, and he will present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So there would be the two goats selected for that day. They would be brought forward. They were just regular goats. And he would cast lots for the goats. You know, draw long straw, short straw, have something like a dice. Possibly he used the Urim and the Thummim because he was the high priest. And he would cast, they would be considered lots in making a decision that Israel would put to God. But whatever the case, the lots were cast, and one goat was designated as the Lord's goat, and the other goat was designated, as it says here, as the scapegoat, which is the English translation of the Hebrew word Azazel. And it's a little bit of an obscure word for the King James translators, so they just called it the scapegoat, meaning the escape goat. It's the goat that escaped. The other one was sacrificed, and this one wasn't, hence the scapegoat. The term scapegoat has then morphed in the English usage based on the ceremony, which means at one time part of the public knew about these ceremonies. Whether they followed them or not, that's another thing. But a scapegoat is somebody who gets blamed for somebody else's problems. And so that they were at one time conversant with that. And Aaron shall bring the goat upon which the Lord's lot fell, verse 9, and offer it as a sin offering. That goat would therefore be slaughtered. And in the typical fashion, according to the regulations of how offerings were to be made, that one would be offered as a blood offering. It would lose its life. But the goat on which the lot fell to be the scapegoat, or the Azazel goat, shall be presented alive before the Lord to make an atonement upon it, and to let it go as the scapegoat into the wilderness. And we'll get to that fulfillment of that later. So it would be then taken aside, and it had to wait until toward the end of the series of ceremonies. Now, most of us are not in the butchering business, so we don't calculate times that would be included here, but with the bull that had to be offered for Aaron, and then the goats having to be offered, and a few other things that had to be done, the atonement ceremony had to take hours. Just to get the things done. It had to take hours. Hours on, and a reasonable amount of energy expenditure on the part of the priests who were involved. A considerable amount at the end of the day on the part of one. But this would all have been done on an empty stomach, which shows that it can be done on an empty stomach. In verse 15, he will kill the goat of the sin offering that is for the people, and he'll bring its blood inside the veil, and to do with that blood as he did with the blood of the bull, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. And he will make atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel. So the Lord's goat actually was anticipatory. It was a prophecy of the sacrifice of Christ. But so was Aaron's bull that he offered, and to prepare himself just to be able to officiate for the rest of the day. Those were all the bloods of the bulls, the blood of the bulls and the goats, and even the turtle doves and the pigeons, those were the smaller things, and the lambs or sheep that were offered were all symbolic ultimately of the shed blood of Christ, the forgiveness of the sins of mankind. They forgave no sins because it wasn't human blood that was being shed for human sin. It was a prophecy of the blood that would be shed and was at the end of Christ's human life. So these were all anticipatory of that. Now we go a little bit further. We come now to the other goat. And when he has made an end of atoning for the holy place and the tabernacle of meeting and the altar, and as well as, and let me interject here, the layout of the tabernacle. The tabernacle would have been similar in dimensions to this room, maybe not quite as wide, or else a little bit higher ceiling. But it was a rectangular affair, and about two-thirds of it constituted the large room. As you entered the doorway, which faced to the east, it always faced to the east, and so did the temple, you would enter the holy place. That, well, you wouldn't, because you have to be a priest to do that. But if you were a priest, that's what you would see. You would walk into the holy place. What would be in there would be the tables, the golden tables upon which the bread would be placed, the showbread. I wonder if that was there on atonement. That would be kind of bothersome. You got this lovely, fragrant bread. You know, this would be better if it was an atonement sermon, wasn't it? I could describe what the bread smelled like, you know, in the enclosed area there. And, you know, you can, bread is, freshly baked bread is one of those things that just energizes all of the digestive juices of the average human being, except for those who are allergic to it, and our apologies to them. They miss out. But we'll eat their share, and we'll tell them about it, you know, how good it was. We'll look forward to the time when they can eat their own share. But whatever the case, the tables would be there. As for the showbread, literally it was on show, was bread that was offered to God, was there. And then there would be the altar of incense, which was, in a way, was kind of a heating source for the temple on the colder days, because it had a fire in it. And that's where the talk about the priests having, each of them having a censer. That doesn't mean somebody that goes by and says, no, you can't say that, no, you can't say this. Censer was a long ladle, normally made out of gold or silver, very rich and beautiful, sometimes inlaid with jewels. And on the end of it was a ladle, shaped into a ladle. So you would scoop out a hot coal from the altar of incense. You'd take up a handful out of the container that would be handy there of powdered incense. The incense was made of frankincense and myrrh and various other ingredients. One family of the tribe of Levi, it's all recorded here in the Pentateuch, one family of the tribe of Levi had the responsibility to make the incense and to preserve the recipe, you know, and hand it down from father to son, as it were. So the priest would take that, and he would probably had a tactic where they would wiggle their little finger, and it would dribble down onto that hot coal and give off this wonderful fragrant scent, filling the holy place. Now the priests, all of the priests, when they were on duty, whatever their opportunity was, they would go into the holy place. They all officiated there. What changed is that they couldn't go behind the back wall, which was actually another curtain or tapestry. In the temple, it was a massive tapestry. Behind that was the other third of the inside of the building, and that was called the most holy place, or sometimes the Holy of Holies. I think in Hebrew, they simply repeat the Hebrew word for holy twice, meaning the most holy place or the Holy of Holies. That's how they do superlatives. We say good, better, best, never let it rest here. Good is better and a better best. And in Hebrew, it's like good, good. Good, good is best, you see. Just good is just good. So that's a little bit of the language aspect of it. But whatever the case, it was on the Day of Atonement that the high priest could go into the most holy place, other than when they were taking it down for transport and setting it up. For any ceremony, it was on the Day of Atonement that he went in there. And you think, well, what was in that room? The Ark of the Covenant with the mercy seat. The mercy seat was the covering of the Ark of the Covenant. We don't know the dimensions specifically, but it was a chest or a trunk, or if you want to call it that, ornate and beautiful, overlaid with gold. And on the top of it was a beautiful covering. And on top of that was the mercy seat. The mercy seat was statuary representation of God's throne, and to the left and the right of it were golden cherubim. That means these were statues of angels. Typically, God forbade the Israelites to make any image of anything in heaven above or in the earth beneath, you know, that they would worship, but certainly not to make anything image of him. But that was the one exception where two angels were made in statuary. In the temple, not only did you have the cherubim that were on the mercy seat itself, but you had two cherubim that were set up in that back room and were very, very large. That would have been the case in Solomon's temple, not so much in the tabernacle, which was the portable temple. So Aaron, as the high priest, could go into the most holy place only on the Day of Atonement and only for the ceremony of sprinkling the blood on the mercy seat and making an atonement for it, you know, seeking God's forgiveness and squaring things away, as it were, for the whole year. So here we are, and he made an end of atoning the holy place, the tabernacle, the meeting, the altar. He shall bring the live goat, which is in verse 20. Now verse 21, Aaron shall lay both hands on the head of the live goat. So this is the goat that didn't get sacrificed. And he will confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions concerning all their sins, and putting them on the head of the goat, and shall send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a suitable man. This is the only animal sacrifice in the entire Levitical sacrificial system in the Bible that doesn't die as a sacrifice. This is unique. It's not like any of the others. When you go through the study of the sacrifices, you'll find that they're all pointing forward to the sacrifice of Christ. Now, there are many who do not keep the Day of Atonement, so they do a lot of speculating about these things. And so in Christianity, some think that, well, you see, God forgives our sins and he removes our sins. So the Azazel goat or the scapegoat is removed from the presence of Israel. But they overlook. They don't have a clear perception of how Satan operates, unfortunately. And that's why our world is so deceived. They overlook the ceremony after Aaron confesses upon that goat all the sins of Israel over the past year. And then he sends it away into the wilderness, an uninhabited region, by the hand of a suitable man. We'll refer back to that part of the ceremony as we go through. It is sent away, and this it is eerily identical to what actually is going to happen as we go forward. Now, with that in mind, now we make one more stop in Leviticus chapter 25 this time and look at one more aspect. Just keep that suitable man scene where he's dragging the goat. Now, they said he had to be a suitable man because I don't know if you've ever broke an animal to lead, a horse or a calf. Calves are notoriously stubborn, or a goat. Goats can be smarter, but they can be more stubborn because they're smarter too. It all depends. We had to do that. Any animal that we, all of our milk cows when they were calves had to be broke to lead. All of our horses had to be broke to lead. And any animal that we needed to use to do something had to be able to be led from one place to another. So my cousin and I got the fun job of breaking everything to lead, meaning he would get a hold of the rope and pull, and I would get behind and shove until the animal got the idea that when you pulled the rope, you were to move forward. And some of them were really stubborn. So you imagine taking a stubborn goat that doesn't want to lead. You had to have a suitable man who had a considerable amount of glucose still left in his muscle cells to drag the thing out of the camp quite some distance, a few miles, and leave it out there in the wilderness and then walk back. A suitable man indeed. Okay, in chapter 25, there's another aspect to the Day of Atonement that is of important significance. And the Lord spoke to Moses, this is right at the beginning, speak to the children of Israel in verse 2. When you come into the land that I give you, the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you'll sow your seed, and 6 years you'll prune your vineyard and gather its fruit. But the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land. This is the land Sabbath. A Sabbath to the Lord, a whole year long, whole agricultural year long. You will neither sow your field or prune your vineyard, etc. Gives other regulations that have to do with that. And that would be every seventh year. So there was a seven-year rhythm to the life of the Israelites. And bear in mind, we'll see that rhythm reproduced and will become the rhythm of the millennium in the White Throne Judgment. Every 7 years, there will be a land Sabbath. However, in verse 8, we find that it is, that isn't it. You know, God designed that to keep the land strong and healthy. Give it a rest. It comes back. It's going to be intensely fertile and give you good food. You don't have to go out and poison it with greater and greater amounts of pesticides, herbicides, and chemical fertilizers, which are all poisons, and then feed what you grow from all the residual poisons to people. And what you don't feed to people, you feed to animals, so they get a more condensed version coming through the animal tissue. Isn't that great? And you know, on the Day of Atonement now, you probably decide, maybe I don't want to eat a steak tonight. You shall count, let's see where we are. I haven't even started verse 8. You shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times, 7 years. The time of 7 Sabbaths of years will be you 49 years. So there's you have 7 years, then you have 7 sets of 7 years. In other words, a total of 49 years. And then you will sound the trumpet of the Jubilee to blow. That means the 50th year is a Jubilee. It is also a land Sabbath, as it goes on to explain. That's all quite fascinating and lots of ramifications as far as how society will be constructed and things that can be done, and I think I've covered that in a recent sermon, but point I want to draw to your attention at this juncture, that the beginning of the Jubilee year, you will cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month on the Day of Atonement. The land Sabbath and the Jubilee years all begin on the Day of Atonement. So you see, God's calendar has 2 new years. The first year's days of the year, in one sense. It has the first day of the first month, back in the spring. But then you come clear into the autumn. It's not the Feast of Trumpets. The Jews use that as their civil new year. The other new year is the agricultural new year. And it starts on the Day of Atonement. So technically, even the tithing was done on that, because in an agronomy society, most of your tithes came as agricultural products. It had to be when the harvest was done. The harvest was finished up in preparation to travel to the Feast of Tabernacles. And Atonement is, you know, that many days before the Feast of Tabernacles gets started. So it gives the time to get all the harvest done, and then the tithes can be brought into the storehouses. And then when you realize, hold it, you have a 7-year cycle, but then you have a third tithe year. You have to understand, the third tithe year was the 3rd year and the 6th year in a 7-year cycle. So it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then there was 7, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then there was 7. Otherwise, if it was every 3rd year repeating, you come to the 21st year, and you would have a third tithe year on a land Sabbath. And there wouldn't be any tithes of significance at all. So it has to be into that rhythm of within the 7-year cycle. But that 7-year cycle was all based on the Day of Atonement. It adds a little excitement to the day, something additional to consider and to weigh. It was, let me find the passage here. You'll proclaim liberty. On the beginning of the Jubilee, the land that was inherited by the families within the tribes, it could be sold if you didn't want to farm. Maybe you wanted to make shoes or tents or something. So you would have a business in the village, and you could sell your land. But when the 50th year came, your land came back. The very next 50th year, it came back. You couldn't get rid of it. It came back into the family. Now, it might not be you. It might be your children or your grandchildren. But the wealth of the owning of the land came back. It was only leased out to somebody until the 50th year. So what that did, and this is an aside to our main topic, but it's interesting. It would move wealth back and forth through the society in a rhythmic fashion. We move wealth back and forth. The rich get poorer, richer, and the poor get poorer. And then suddenly we have this thing that happens that shuffles the wealth cards back across the population in America and, frankly, all the rest of the nations to a large extent, not nearly as efficient as the land Sabbath would do, except it's an economic depression, typically, is what it is. The 1880s, the 1930s, and then, you know, we're bound to have one before long. Pretty close to about 50 years apart. It's much more traumatic than having the land Sabbath, which started on the Day of Atonement. So here we have the Day of Atonement factoring into a lot of additional things that we haven't thought about. Liberty is proclaimed. You shall proclaim liberty. Blowing of the trumpet on the Day of Atonement proclaims the liberty. Those who were indentured servants, they had their freedom. Those who didn't own their land and had sold it until the Jubilee, they got their land back. So you had freedom or liberty to live, economic liberty in that sense. But we're going to see that there was another kind of liberty that was proclaimed and is proclaimed on the Day of Atonement. It's liberty from evil. Evil shall be bound. It'll be removed and you will be free from it. And it will be free ultimately when that Day of Atonement is fulfilled. Now, let's look at the evil that needs to be bound, starting with prophecies that we have come to see are very clearly about Satan in Isaiah 14. Well, let's look at that one to start with. Isaiah chapter 14. It is a prophecy about a king of Babylon that Isaiah is giving. But when you get to the beginning of it, you get a different language. There's a setting for this. Mercy on Jacob in the first few verses. For the Lord will have mercy on Jacob and choose Israel and settle them in their own land. The strangers will be joined with them and they will cling to the house of Jacob, and the people will take them and bring them to their place in the land of house of Israel, will possess them for servants and maids in the land of the Lord. And they will take them captive, whose captives they were, and rule over their oppressors. And you think, well, when did that happen? The answer is it didn't happen. This is a prophecy. Isaiah started his ministry, began to prophesy, when Israel was a vassal kingdom of the Assyrian Empire. They conquered them, hauled off their gold, and charged high taxes for them. The Israelites, being good Israelites as they are, or classic Israelites as they are, they rebelled. They didn't like taxes that were that high. We've heard that before. So they rebelled, and the Assyrians came that time, and they thrashed the Israelite army. This would have been in about 735 B.C., thrashed the Israelite army, and they hauled off Zebulun and Naphtali, a half-tribe of Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben. The top tribes up on the north end of the Sea of Galilee and everything on the east side of the Jordan, they took them off and deported them. And they left the remnant of the country there and told them, you better pay your taxes or we're going to come beat you up again. Well, that wasn't enough for the Israelite kings, and true to form, they rebelled again in about 718 B.C. That was about 15 or so years later. They went through the whole thing, and this time they came and they besieged Samaria. That was the capital city of the northern kingdom of Israel. The Assyrians did, and they destroyed it. After 3 years, they'd taken everybody else captive, probably, but Assyria wanted to make sure they took out the capital city. And they took it out, and they took what was left of the people inside and hauled them off and deported them into the Assyrian Empire. Those are the lost 10 tribes of Israel, and they never came back. Oh, maybe a family here or a family there. But most of those had separated from their house of Israel before and had moved down and lived with the Jews. And they'd done that hundreds of years earlier when they had the civil war at the end of Solomon's life. So what Isaiah is talking about has not happened. The 10 tribes did not come back en masse and settle in Israel. The Jews did. See, the Jews were going to be taken captive about 130 years after Isaiah, by the Babylonians. The Babylonians at the time Isaiah wrote chapter 14, the Babylonians were only a province in the Assyrian Empire. Their day came when they became the dominant force, and they booted out the Assyrian overlords, and then they began to flex their muscles, and the house of Judah was what was left of the Israelites. And they took them captive after time, you know, in Jeremiah's day, which was, like I said, about a century after Isaiah. They took them captive, and the Jews came back. A significant portion of them resettled the land in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, so that they had an official Jewish presence there, and that was the presence that grew in population until the time of Christ, and shortly thereafter, until the temple was destroyed. So what Isaiah is writing here isn't about the Jews, it's about the Israelites, and it's never been, it hasn't happened yet. So it's yet something of the future. And it shall come to pass in the day the Lord gives you rest from your sorrow and from your fear and the hard bondage with which you've been made to serve, that you will take up this proverb against the king of Babylon. See, the Israelites suffered consequences of the Assyrians, but we know from prophecies about the Great Tribulation, when you put these all together, that they're going to suffer more in our time when everything comes down to another world war. So this is what they'll say about this king of Babylon, who is actually a type. He's a human, but he's a type of somebody who's not a human. How the oppressor has ceased, and the golden city ceased, and the Lord has broken the staff of the wicked and the scepter of the rulers who struck the people in wrath with a continual stroke. He who ruled the nations in anger is persecuted, and no one hinders. And God has done that. He did that to the Babylonians. He did it to the emperors of Assyria and Persia as well at times. You know, he's made the persecuting emperors suffer consequences. The whole earth is at rest and quiet. They break forth into singing, and indeed the cypress trees rejoice over you. When this king of Babylon that is being spoken of here is gone, then everybody starts to sing because the relief from the tension and from the oppression has suddenly disappeared. And the cedars of Lebanon, who was saying, since you were cut down, no woodsman has come up against us. There will be world peace when this king of Babylon is gone. It goes on talking about that in that king, and there's going to be a shift in Isaiah's poem here in a moment when it starts to talk about somebody else. But there are allusions to that somebody else already. Hell from beneath, the grave from beneath, is excited about you to meet you at your coming. That would apply to a physical king. It stirs up the dead for you and the chief ones of the earth. As figurative languages, the dead are dead. The dead know not anything, so there's no immortal souls jumping up and down for joy that this guy is coming to join them. But it is a figurative language. The kings of the nations, and they will all speak and say to you, have you become as weak as we? Have you become like us? Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, that's the grave, and the sound of your stringed instruments. The maggot is spread over you and worms cover you. Sometimes we just don't appreciate the vivid imagery of biblical poetry. The maggot is spread over you and the worms cover you. There was a reason why it was put that way. But suddenly there's a complete shift. There's a different kind of creature being talked about. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down, you who weakened the nations. For you said in your heart, and Satan has weakened the nations. This is what Lucifer means, light bringer. And that's what he was. When he was a holy angel. But something happened, something changed, and we're going to read about that. You have said in your heart, this was the change. Started thinking, I will ascend into heaven. I'll be in charge. I'll exalt my throne above the stars of God. Stars are a symbol of angels. You know, I'll be in charge of all the angels. He failed on that 2-1. He is in charge of a third of them. A third of the angels followed him. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation in the farthest sides of the north. Mount of the congregation in the farthest sides of the north. Now, sitting on the mountain signifies ruling. The mount being, again, a nation or nations that are being ruled. The farthest sides of the north. Why are you going north? Let's turn back, if you hold your place here, and go back to Psalm 75. Let me show this. Somehow, in some way, Google Maps doesn't help. God's throne is north of earth. Not in northern earth, but north of earth. Somehow. Chapter 7, or Psalm 75. Let me just read through it. We give thanks to you, O God. We give thanks for your wondrous works and declare that your name is near. When I choose the proper time, I will judge uprightly. The earth and its inhabitants are dissolved. I will set its pillars firmly. That seems to be the voice of God. I said to the boastful, do not deal boastfully, and to the wicked, do not lift up the horn. Do not lift up your horn on high. Lifting your horn on high was an attitude of arrogance, presumably having your horn blown, either yourself or somebody else. Do not speak with a stiff neck. We can get that one. For notice verse 6, though. Exaltation comes neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south. But God is the judge. He puts down one and exalts another. God exalts somebody. He raises them up to a position of importance. He gave Lucifer a very important job as one of the covering cherubim, as we'll see. But notice there were only 3 points of the compass mentioned here in the psalm. East, west, and south. No north. In place of north, you're talking about God. So then we come back to Isaiah. We have Satan, in essence, saying these things, the five arrogant eyes. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit in the mount of the congregation on the farther sides of the north. They said, somehow, and we'll understand it later, God, the spiritual location of God's throne is north of the earth. It'll be interesting to see how it juxtapositions when the time comes and we can comprehend all of that stuff. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Satan wanted to be God himself. He thought he could knock off God off of his throne and that he could take his place. It's impossible. The created is never more powerful than the Creator. But that's the lunacy of the devil. And that's the lunacy of those who think like him as well. So we find here Satan's I, almost like Adolf Hitler and some of the chants that he would do on the big speeches he gave back in the 30s to stir up the German people. It was almost as if he was, as they say, channeling another spirit, in which I believe he was. So we have then, we have Satan's rebellion aeons ago. We don't know exactly how long ago, but we know it was a long time ago. We have ego-driven sins of pride. The I. The ego. Certain types of unrighteous anger, pure selfishness are typical of that. Things that we want to watch out for that we don't exhibit those. We can learn from what we read here of Lucifer. But now we can see more in the parallel passage or a similar passage. It's not exactly parallel because it's a king of Tyre, this time instead of a king of Babylon, who is the type of Satan, but it's in Ezekiel 28. Let's look at that for a minute. Ezekiel chapter 28. The word of the Lord came to me, verse 1, saying, Son of man, say to the prince of Tyre, thus says the Lord, because your heart is lifted up and you say, I am a god, I sit in the seat of the gods, in the midst of the seas, yet you are a man and not a god, though you set your heart as the heart of a god. Behold, are you wiser than Daniel? Who do you think you are? He goes on chiding him there, but we'll follow along. You can see how you see the ego of a king of Tyre. Tyre is different. Babylon is in Iraq, right where it used to be. It's the ruins of what was left of the ancient city. Tyre is on the north coast, the north western coast of Lebanon. Not terribly far from Beirut, but that was where Tyre, the ancient world, was located. It was a coastal city. There were times when the Tyrites, or the Phoenicians, as they were later called by the Greeks, which would include Tyre and Sidon. Sidon was north of Asher and north of Zebulun and Naphtali, in Lebanon, the southern Syria. And then it bordered up to Tyre's territory or kingdom, and they seemed to be allied, and together they were referred to as the Phoenicians. Those from Tyre were the sailors. They were at times allies with Israel, good allies. Hiram was a trusted friend of King David and of King Solomon. And Solomon sent Israelites to sail with the men of Tyre. And Hiram had many skilled craftsmen that helped in the construction of the temple and in a lot of the other buildings that David had built and that Solomon later built. So there were times when there was a close association between Israel and Tyre. It was a good one. But this king of Tyre was not a good one. Verse 11, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to be saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre and say to him, Thus says the Lord, You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty, a magnificent angelic being. You were in Eden, the garden of God." And you think, what does that mean? Well, it's pretty easy to figure out. There were two humans in the Garden of Eden. Not counting all the animals, we're talking people, you know, either humans, angels, or God. And there were two humans in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve. And because they did what they did, they got sent out of the garden. But then there was the snake, the serpent of old. He was there too, but he wasn't really a snake. It was Lucifer or the devil. And of course God was there. So you were in Eden, the garden of God. You were right there. Every precious stone was your covering. And Eden was a reference, you know, an allusion to being at the throne of God. So it was the physical Eden was a type of God's throne in the spirit realm. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardius, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, sapphire, turquoise, emerald with gold, and the workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you in the day you were created. And these are not hookah pipes or whatever those pipes are called. These timbrels and pipes are musical instruments. Lucifer was given phenomenal musical talent. Phenomenal musical talent. He hasn't lost the talent. He has changed his music. See, music is a very powerful influence on the human mind. For good, if it is good. Or for evil. And there have been various types of music. One that we saw that had the demonic tone to it was the acid rock of the late 1960s and early 70s. But people have become adulterers and done all kinds of things, and they're motivated largely in part by the music that they love. That was the rhythm they liked to think of and to move to, and they did a lot of bad things, a lot of evil things to the wrong kind of music. Thus, you have to be very careful with your music. You have to analyze what you're listening to. And who is really inspiring this kind of music? And you have to sort through and find only the ones that have real, genuine value and that are uplifting and not down-pulling. It goes on in verse 14. You were the anointed cherub. You might say cherub in America. I learned cherub in England because they say cherubs over there. You were the anointed cherub who covers. The cherub who covers were the cherubim who, as I said, nailed at one side and the other side of God's throne, and then their wings, two of their wings would then overarch the throne of God. And likewise, the statuary of those overarch the mercy seat on the top of the Ark of the Covenant as a representation of what existed in the heavens. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. That's the government of God. Mountain is symbolic of a government. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. And you say, what are the fiery stones? And didn't that hurt? No, it's a spirit being. It doesn't hurt. But it wasn't fiery stones like that. It's the sea of crystal in the front of, under where God's throne is, and lightnings come out from the throne of God. So you have the fire of the lightning dancing through the crystal, which is a stone, a type of rock in physical realm, that becomes the fiery stones. That's where Lucifer would have gone back and forth. When he wasn't on duty as one of the covering cherub, then he had other administrative duties for who knows how long in the way, you know, in compared to the way we count our time now, until wickedness was found in him, sin was found in him. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created. So we're talking about a created being, and all the angels were created until iniquity was found in you, until you sinned. By the abundance of your trading, You became filled with violence within. And you think, what did he trade? Did the angels have baseball cards back then? Or stock, stocks and bonds? No. Satan traded in false information, rumors, secrets. And he basically started a whispering campaign against God. A whispering campaign that caused a vast casualty rate among the holy angels. One third of them chose to not become holy angels, but to become demons. By the abundance of, and that's an abundance, frankly. There, you know, we don't know how many angels there are, but it talks about thousands upon thousands and ten thousands beside. So millions, billions maybe, we don't know. By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within, and you sinned. The angels had to make a choice at a certain time, but Lucifer chose to sin. Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God. I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stone. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. Here's the postmortem. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. You acted out of vanity. I cast you to the ground and laid you before kings that they may gaze at you. So you have a physical monarch, the king, this king of Tyre, and we don't know who specifically he was. But what the poetry then shifts, and then it's talking about Lucifer, talking about Satan, or the devil, as he came to have the new titles. This is the kind of trouble that we can thank the devil for. Let me show you some more. Let's go to the New Testament now. John 8:44. So it helps us perhaps to understand what we are as God's people today, what we're up against, and what the world really doesn't know it's up against. Well, they talk about, in Christianity, they talk about Satan. They read some of the verses. They do have an inkling of that. They don't know what I just told you, for the most part. That's not in their thinking. John chapter 8 and verse 44 is the passage that we want to read. Here it is. Now, Christ is in a confrontation with some of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And it's a real sharp argument going on. And he lays it on the line in verse 44. He says to them, "You are of your father, the devil. And the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning." And the Jews had a penchant for murder, usually with a religious fervor. A lot of innocent people were killed by their stonings, as well as some who were guilty. "He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources. He is a liar and a father of it." God has called us out of the world that imitates this devil. It doesn't have the truth of God. He has called us, brethren, to understand his truth. The world does not comprehend it. Not even the religious world, and in some ways, especially not the religious world. Traditional Christianity is blind to this, for the most part. They have an inkling here, an inkling there, but they have inherited false doctrines that skew their understanding of the Scriptures, unless God calls one of them out of that, as he has many of you, and then suddenly everything begins to make sense. Satan is the father of liars. There is no truth in him. But he can make it appear like there is. Let's look at 2 Corinthians 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Paul starts out in verse 1, he says, "Therefore, since we have this ministry, we have received mercy if we don't lose heart." In other words, there is always the challenge of losing heart and the danger of losing heart, getting discouraged and unable to move forward and following God's way and doing his work. "But we have renounced the hidden things of shame, We have renounced the hidden things of shame. What are the hidden things of shame? Well, one is we have renounced any kind of admiration for Satan and his ideas. And any kind of sin in our own lives, we have renounced that and we strive against it. And not walking in craftiness or handling the word of God deceitfully. In other words, we try to be absolutely honest with God's word. But by manifestation of the truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. But even if our gospel is veiled, and the true gospel of God's kingdom is veiled to this world. God lifts the veil here and there as he calls one of us to know the truth. He's beginning to do that a little bit more. It's been a good while since there was any significant amount of that, but we've had some baptisms in our areas, and we're thankful for that. It is veiled to those who are perishing, though. The world doesn't understand God's way. It's as if it's veiled. They can't see it. Whose minds the God of this age has blinded. And no clever arguments, trying to sort of identify with them can make that clear to them. God has to lift the veil so they can see the truth. We know that process. We went through that process. When we didn't know one end from the other of God's way, it didn't make any sense to us when a relative or a friend was being called into the church. And then God gave us the bug. He lifted the veil and suddenly it started to make sense. And pretty soon it made so much sense that you realize, I can't ignore this anymore. I have to start living this way. And so you did. And so we all did, ultimately. That's how it works. Chapter 11. A little bit more. Satan blinds the eyes of the world. In chapter 11, Paul starts in verse 12, but what I do, I will continue to do, that I may cut off opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the things that they boast. They are false apostles. There were those who made themselves self-styled apostles. See, Christianity, true Christianity, was a new religion at this time. So there were people like Simon Magus in Acts chapter 8 that realized, ooh, there's money to be made here. And power to exert. And so he tried to become an apostle. He tried to buy an apostleship from Peter and John. And Peter told him where he could take his offer and go. Well, there were others who did the same kind of thing. Such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. Claiming to be followers of Jesus Christ, but in fact they weren't. For Satan himself, and Paul says in verse 14, and no wonder, it makes sense, perfect sense. For Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. So it's no great thing if his ministers transform themselves into ministers of righteousness whose end will be according to their works. Satan is a deceiver, a liar, a deceiver, and a murderer. He hates. And he especially hates those who have been called by God to be a part of his family. That includes especially the Church of God down through time, including this time today in which we are drawing breath, and then throughout the rest of human history. God is going to call the rest of the world to know the truth. Some in the millennium, and the rest in the great white throne judgment. That is, those who are of the billions that will be involved there, there will be still a few in this age that will be called. In Ephesians chapter 2, right at the beginning of the chapter, we read this. And you, meaning us, he made alive, who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air. We did that. We used to live like that. Or our families did, if those who have been in the church for more than a generation. But there was a time when that was the way everybody was. They just went the way of the society. Following the prince of the power of the air. Prince of the power of the air. That's an interesting title. As if he's broadcasting evil intentions and moods and attitudes. And if we let ourselves be susceptible to those, we end up sinning. Badly. And dangerously. The spirit. This prince of the power of the air is the spirit who works in the sons of disobedience. The disobedient and sinful culture that we see around us in our country and in all the rest of the countries around the world are that way because Satan is the prince of the power of the air that works in them, inciting them to greater and greater evils. Among whom we once also conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilled the desires of the flesh and the mind, and were like by nature children of wrath, just as others. But God, who is rich in mercy, called us out of that. So we find this is the kind of trouble we can thank the devil for getting us into. And we can thank God for getting us out of. In order for us to be united with the Father and with Christ as our Savior, we have to get Satan away from us. And so here is the process by which this will take place. It's not just our own, just us resisting the devil and he will flee from us. That's part of it on a personal level. But there has to be more. There has to be a final solution for the devil's work. And it is in chapter 20 of Revelation. Chapter 20 of Revelation. First three verses it begins, "And I saw an angel," John writes, "coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit or the great abyss, and a great chain in his hand." Now this is not a physical chain. You can't chain the devil up with a physical chain. This is a spirit chain. "And he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan." And that's enough of his names that we cannot mistake who he's got a hold of. "And he bound him for 1,000 years and cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things he must be released for a little while. So Satan is bound. All evil is bound, but then it's released at the end of the millennium for a short time. We speculate why. We don't know exactly why, but one thing it certainly will be when all is said and done, the conclusion will be that it's like an exclamation point. Only God's way works. No other way works. No human devised way, no satanically devised way. Only God's way works. Only God's way. "And when the 1,000 years had expired," in verse 7, "Satan will be released from his prison, and he'll go out and deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog," which by that time, Gog and Magog just meant the four corners of the earth everywhere, not a specific geographical location as it means in another prophecy, "to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea." And we mull this over at the end of the feast, because that's when we're coming up on that time in anticipation. And it's just a sad contemplation as to why. "And they went up from the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city." And everybody comes to Jerusalem. "And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them." And then, getting back to the topic at hand, the devil, who deceived them, just like he has been deceiving the world and he deceived us and still does when we let him, the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and false prophet are, and the bar is in italics, it should be were cast, and Satan and the demons will be tormented day and night forever and ever. See, the ever-burning hell for immortal souls being tortured constantly, in agony constantly, is actually a lot more like what Satan and the demons are going to get. But he has foisted off his fate into the minds of Christianity to think that's the fate of the unrepentant people. A clever tactic. He is clever. Evil clever. Not the kind of clever that you want to emulate. But the bottom line is that the devil will get his due. He will get what he has coming, and God's kingdom will move forward into deep eternity, richer, more beautiful, and magnificent than ever. And we will have a part of that. However, we've got to give credit where credit is due. We've got to thank Mama for the cooking, Papa for the whooping, and we need those now and then. The devil for the trouble that I get into, I've got to give credit where credit is due. That's the credit that the devil is due.